number of trips to Mars, assuming the booster and the spacecraft can be made cheap enough, and by the economy of scale, it's going to get cheaper as you do more of them. But still, as I see it, the numbers don't come out right. Colonizing. I mean, when people moved from Europe to North America, and they became colonists, and they were pilgrims, they were moving into a land that had soil, Native Americans, air, water, plants, all kinds of stuff. You go to Mars, it's the driest, coldest desert you'll ever find. Average temperature is something like minus 60 degrees, so you're going to have tremendous amount of energy required just to keep your habitat warm. You're going to have to use a tremendous amount of energy to melt the local ice to try to get water out of it. But the biggest thing we need, a human being, let me drop it. The biggest thing you need immediately is air. And we take that for granted. Those pilgrims that came to the United States, the air was guaranteed to be here with 21% or 20% oxygen content and normal air pressure. The air on Mars is 0.6% of the air pressure on Earth, and the amount of oxygen in that air is 0.13 of 0.13%. Let's just look at what a human being does. Each breath you take is roughly a liter of air in volume, and you take in the vicinity of 20 breaths per minute. Therefore, you go through the mathematics of that, you're going to breathe 1 cubic meter of air in roughly an hour. In a 24-hour day, you're going to breathe something close to 24 cubic meters of air. Okay? 20 cubic meters of air is approximately the amount of air that's in the volume of your bedroom. Assuming your bedroom is 10 foot by 15 feet, there's around 20 cubic meters of air in your bedroom. So your lungs take in and exhale an amount of air equal to the volume of your bedroom. And that air contains 20% oxygen, and you're pretty happy to breathe that. On Mars, if you've got machinery that can process that air and suck the oxygen out of it, because the air pressure is so low and the oxygen content is so low, you will need the volume of the Wembley Stadium per day per man. If your machinery that's sucking the oxygen out of the air on Mars for you to breathe...
Repeater, time out.
Each 24-hour day, it must process the amount of volume of air that's in the Wembley Stadium. It's a 1,000-foot diameter stadium, something like 100 feet tall. That volume of air must be processed with near 100% efficiency per day per human being that's living on Mars. And that air has to be heated, compressed, and processed to suck the oxygen out of it. I can't believe that he has concerned himself with that degree of difficulty yet. And that's assuming the machinery can do it with 100% efficiency. To grow plants on Mars, with such a thin atmosphere, the plants are not going to live. Your greenhouse on Mars is going to have to be pressurized. On Earth, it takes roughly an acre of property to support a human being if you've got rather efficient agriculture. On Mars, each acre of property is going to have to be pressurized. Wow. I mean, you think you're going to ship... I mean, if you look at the Progress ships that are bringing up consumables to the International Space Station, tons of equipment are being brought up, tons of stuff is being brought to those astronauts every couple of months. If you think there's going to be a great big supply chain across the 100 million miles between Earth and Mars to continuously supply oxygen and food and energy, a Pilgrim going to Mars is going to have to be self-sustaining. And now I'm giving you the most basic thing you need is air. And just to get the right air...
Repeater, time out.
Just to get the right amount of oxygen out of that air on Mars is a heroic effort with a megawatts of energy requirement to do that. The Wembley Stadium's volume of air per day must be processed to support one human being for that day. It's not going to happen. I don't like being negative. I like space research. And the fact that around 2020 we're going to be sending a high-power version of the Curiosity rover to send an unmanned vehicle to Mars to make all kinds of fancy measurements, to create a real high-power laboratory on Mars by way of an unmanned vehicle, nuclear-powered, that makes a lot of sense. Why in the world would you want to put human beings there? It would take many centuries to modify Mars in such a way that it really is easily habitable for human beings. If you did terraforming, reprogramming Mars, so to speak, if you had the resources to do that, it would take centuries to do it. I mean, Elon Musk makes it sound like human beings, let me draft it. Human beings should have two places to live, Mars and Earth. We shouldn't put all our eggs in one basket, only living on Earth. Logical sounding if you don't dig into the specifics. But to maintain a human being in a self-sustaining manner in that vacuum cold desert of Mars, living in a spacesuit, we've already discussed that, sitting in your habitat 24 hours a day, getting cabin fever, having machinery that's processing the local air, giving you something you can breathe, and where in the world is the megawatts of energy going to come from to run all this machinery? And if that machinery hiccups and you're not getting oxygen for a few hours, it's game over. So there's a huge degree of difficulty that he is not discussing yet. He as a spacecraft creator, is worried about having the right amount of thrust, the right amount of fuel, the right amount of volume, the right amount of range to get that spacecraft there. For him to develop the spacecraft, which gives us better and better ability to ship unmanned vehicles there, he's doing the right thing. But if he thinks he's going to send human beings there, you can tell I'm extremely skeptical. Do you think I'm being overly negative on this one, not Paul? WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet?
I know he believes that most of the oxygen could be recycled, which we're starting to get there now with the saboteur equipment on board the International Space Station. Most of the oxygen is recycled, but most of the flights that go up, most recently was a SpaceX flight where they send up these 6,000 pound, 6,000 pounds per square inch oxygen tanks. They send them up because they don't have the ability to do it 100%. But I guess maybe he thinks further down the road they'll be able to do that. He's thinking like, to me it looks like the shipbuilder, I'm going to build a ship, I'll send anything you want, people, material, equipment, tools, over to the other side, And what you guys do when you get there, that'll be up to you. That's what I think. He's interested in the rocket and the fuel and the calculations on how to get there. He wants to cut back the amount of time. He's got it down to 80 days, which is a lot better than, you're looking at 3 months instead of 6 or 8 months, which is the way it is now. He works on those kinds of details. Reusability. He believes as long as you can reuse all his rockets, and that includes the one that lands on Mars.
Coming.
The one that lands on Mars will eventually take off again. And where's that fuel going to come from? He manufacture that out of the gas and the rocks and whatever's on Mars. Set up this fueling plant to develop this liquefied methane, you know, and then get this thing all the way back to Earth, and eventually land it back on Earth. He has these refueling tankers going up on a regular basis. Brad's fascinated with the rocket itself, and he's looking at 28 million pounds of thrust on the rocket that's going to take off from Earth. You know, the Saturn V was, what, 7.5 million pounds of thrust to send people to the moon. This guy's going to do 28 million pounds of thrust. The SLS is supposed to be bigger than Saturn V when they, you know, out there. You know, they're a bigger version. They call it the Block 1B, and that will be around 10.5 million pounds of thrust. This guy's almost three times that amount. So it's going to be interesting between him and, let me drop it, and Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin, who I think a week or two ago I discussed their new rocket, the new Glenn that's coming out. And that's going to be very large as well. That's bigger than, it's almost, I would say it's a little bit bigger than the volume-wise than the Saturn V. So he's another one. And he'll be launching from Florida probably 2019 with his first rocket. So, now they got nothing to hold them back. You know, they don't have to, you know, go to Congress to get more money. You know, they're all self-funding billionaires. So we'll see how it goes, Dick. You know, but I'm looking at probably NASA first there in maybe 2035. I'm going to go, that will be the earliest. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, we're going to pick up less in a second. Let me run that back to you, Paul. Are you saying that NASA is specifically saying, independent of Elon Musk, that by 2035 they predict that NASA will be sending human beings to Mars? Has NASA said anything along those lines, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, last year they had a report, 40 different SLS launches between now and then. And that should set up a space station around Mars 2035. And then by the end of that, you know, 2039, they should be sending landers down to the surface with people. So now, just recently, Orbital ATK, they launched the Cygnus cargo ships up to the space station. They plan on, you know, trying to convince NASA. NASA likes the idea where they can send their Cygnus spacecraft that are usually used for cargo to the orbit of the moon. Actually called the L2 position at the moon, and then send a series of these Cygnus crafts instead of being used for cargo, will have people and set up your own space station at that location. So that type of thing will occur first over the years, and each one of these flights would involve an SLS, a Space Launch System, one of the newer rockets that NASA is developing. So, and then at some time in the future, you would again take an SLS and get it to the moon, completely refueled, and launch this whole space station out of L2 orbit, push it all the way to Mars. Now you'll have a space station at Mars. And these are all things that are on the board. They're not being financed really yet. You know, they need approval, but these are things that they're looking at. Back to you, Dick.
You mentioned reprocessing oxygen out of the carbon dioxide. I'll talk about that in a minute. Wes wants to I'll say something. N2XAN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, it's the project being called Helena, H-E-L-E-N-A, which is originated by the team of Australian scientists, young guys. That's a Helena payload project. They have a method of extracting water from Martian soil and using electrolysis to produce breathable air. Let me drop. Also, there are two students from MIT, program Mars Oxygen, and the resource utilization experiment called MOXI, M-O-X-I-E. This one was selected for inclusion on board NASA Mars 220 rover. They also propose using solid oxide electrolysis to quell oxygen of carbon dioxide, splitting into O2 and carbon monoxide. Now, as far as some other news in this area, volunteers from Russia, that was dated at December 24, 2015, team of people for 520 days locked in the bunker, habitation module, and breathing sort of Martian air. Let me drop. So the experiment showed that argon combined with right portion of oxygen is safe to human. This could be another Russian story, if not that it was credited by NASA. And to actually,
when it comes to finding oxygen to keep the people on Mars alive, I previously discussed what it would be like if you're going to take the oxygen directly out of the air. If you're now going to stay out up with the carbon dioxide, which is a lot of percentage of the very thin atmosphere on Mars, does contain carbon dioxide. The human beings breathe out primarily carbon dioxide, and if you can reprocess the carbon dioxide and get the oxygen back out of it, it sounds good. But let me give you some very quick numbers on that. A human being that's alive is continuously metabolizing, creating 130 watts of heat. If you take an old-fashioned 130-watt incandescent light bulb and you measure the amount of heat coming off of it, that's the amount of heat that a live human being is continuously generating. You're generating that by metabolizing. The oxygen you breathe gets mixed together with your food, so to speak, and out comes 130 watts of heat plus some energy. So the oxygen we breathe gives us the 130 watts. If now you take the carbon dioxide coming out of a human being and you want to reverse the process, if you could do it with 100% efficiency, I think it would take 130 watts of energy to do that. For one human being continuously reprocessing the carbon dioxide, I mean, you're not going to get something for nothing. We got energy out of creating that oxygen by combining that oxygen with the carbon and making carbon dioxide. I think you're going to have to expend an equal amount of energy to do it in reverse. Let me drop. In the case of reprocessing carbon dioxide to get the oxygen back out of it on the International Space Station, where they've got this huge solar panel array with lots of kilowatts of energy, they've got the raw energy to do that. So to process enough oxygen by reclaiming the oxygen out of carbon dioxide, it's going to take some pretty fancy machinery and quite a bit of energy into that machinery to do it. So, did they give any of the specifics of how easy it is? I mean, you don't want to just use chemistry to do it, because the raw chemistry, you're going to run out of it. You really got to do direct processing of the carbon dioxide to get the oxygen back out of it. And so I hear you say, Paul, that the first step is you get some oxygen with carbon monoxide left over, You're not able to completely remove all the carbon from the carbon dioxide. And once again, did they discuss how many watts required to run that machinery, assuming the machinery runs at 100% efficiency? WS2N, KQLIW in the TechNet.
On the space station, they have it on the Tranquility module. That was the third node that was sent up. We have Unity, you have Harmony, and Tranquility. Tranquility, is, you have the Saboteur machine located there, and that's doing this work. And it broke down a lot in the beginning. They changed out valves and this and that, but from what I understand, it's working pretty good. And they're taking the carbon dioxide, separating it, and getting oxygen, and then the carbon is left over. And eventually they have some other process they want to do. So it's still not a closed loop system. I don't remember the chemistry. But, you know, they are working on that. So let's suppose they have that solved in 10 or 20 years. That would help. But right now they are getting quite a bit of oxygen back out of the what they're breathing through the Saboteur machine. Apparently this guy Saboteur must have, I think he was the guy that invented this, you know, 100 years ago or something, and they named it after him. So that's working. As far as power goes, yeah, they have like, you know, easily over 200 kilowatts of power on this thing that Elon Musk is going to send to Mars, the interplanetary transport. Let me drop it. The video that they show shows you two very large fan-like solar panels coming out. And he claims it's going to have 200 kilowatts. You know, you just do some scaling up with the with what I'm looking at, and it doesn't look anywhere big enough to equal the amount of solar panels that the space station has, which would be roughly about the same. So unless he goes nuclear, I think he's going to have a problem, but theoretically he thinks he has enough power to operate the spaceship all the way until it gets to Mars. And then they don't say what happens when he gets to Mars. They fold this thing back up again, it lands, and then eventually takes off. Who's going to set up the infrastructure originally to create the all this methane he needs from Mars, put it into the cryogenic tanks? And, you know, there's a lot of stuff that needs to be done besides just launching a rocket to and from Mars. But I think he's hoping that investors and people get all interested in this and join his party. But he's going to have a hard time. I think he's over-optimistic. And everybody knows he's over-optimistic, but they do show a timeline. So, can't imagine this rocket taking off from 39A. They say 39A was overbuilt when it was originally built, and it should be able to support a 28 million pound thrust rocket. Back to you, Dick. I'm losing my voice. WS.
You think you've got a cold, and you sound a lot better than you think you do, Paul. The amount of sunlight you get at Mars is something like 46% of the sunlight we get at Earth, because it's at a greater number of astronomical units. It's further away from the sun. So if he thinks he's going to get the same kind of power that you're getting from the solar cells on the International Space Station, he's got to make his solar cells 2.5 times more area because of less sunlight, and they better be super efficient. So that's a serious problem. You did say that this fancy machine on the International Space Station is processing carbon dioxide and giving them oxygen plus carbon. Is there a rough guess, Paul, of the oxygen the astronauts on the International Space Station are breathing right now? What's your guess as to what percentage of that is oxygen brought up by the cargo ships oxygen in their breathing is reprocessed. Over you, Paul. KQRIW.
I read over half. I read over 80%. I'll have to go back and double check that. That's quite a while back I read that. It's been up there for quite a few years. In the beginning, they didn't have that. So, they used to bring up a lot more oxygen when the space shuttle was coming up there. Things are a little different now. Ever since the shuttle stopped, you can't bring up what we used to. So, yeah, I think it's over 80%. And, they bring up these tanks. And it was lasting a long time. It was like a couple of years or so before they brought up this last set of tanks they brought up last year. It was quite a gap. So I know there's plenty of oxygen on board. Between the Russians and the United States, there's plenty of backup. That's a problem too. You know, we haven't had many flights going up with new cargo. Cygnus was delayed. The HT2 vehicle by Japan, that's been delayed. That should have gone up by now. And now Progress, maybe that might be delayed. We're still waiting on a next manned flight. That they had a problem with their crew vehicle. So that should have gone up on the 23rd of September. That might not go up until the last day of October. So supplies, they have plenty of supplies on board.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
100 people suffering all the way to Mars, wondering about, should we draw straws? Who's going to draw something like one of those old movies? Who's going to be sucking the last bit of oxygen out of you if something fails? So there's a lot of work. But they got to start somewhere. And if he's willing to put up the money, sounds good to me. I'll watch it fly. Back to you, Dick.
I think I heard you say a couple of months ago, Paul, that the Progress ships, one of the main things they bring up is a whole lot of water. Not only because the astronauts want to drink water, but I think you told me that for a while they were doing electrolysis of the water to separate the hydrogen and oxygen as a way of getting the oxygen. So question number one, are they doing that or did I misunderstand it? And question number two, when you pour electricity by the electrolysis process into water to separate the oxygen and the hydrogen, it takes a fair amount of energy. This other carbon dioxide reprocessing machine also takes quite a bit of energy to separate the oxygen from the carbon. In either of those processes, do they say the number of kilowatts of energy required to run those two machines? And yes, because they've got lots of kilowatts from those solar cells, they've got the power. But knowing how much power is required would be kind of interesting if you happen to know. WS2N, KQRIW.
Yeah, I've got some PDF files on the Saboteur machine. It must be in that. So I'll find it. They have separated a lot of oxygen from the water. And that used to be even more popular with the space shuttle. Space shuttle had fuel cells on board. So you combine oxygen and hydrogen to make electricity. And then the waste product was water. And eventually the water would be reused. And so much, but they didn't know what to do with it. So they spent a lot of time separating the end. And I guess eventually, anytime they went to a space station, they probably unloaded over, into the atmosphere of the space station. I know they're doing pretty good with six people on board now. That's what I wanted to say. There's six people on board with 200 watts of energy. All right, yeah, 200 kilowatts of energy. They're operating all the equipment and all the tests. Everything uses up a lot of power. You know, you want to be doing that on the way to Mars, but theoretically with 100 people instead of six. Wow. Yeah. I'll have to see a lot more reports come out before I know that his timeline is within reason, but I think he's probably off by about 10 years, but we'll see. You never know. If some other billionaire gets involved with this, gives them more money, that's what it's going to take, because
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Individual like this. Back either.
Okay, what's recognized? How much of the water on board is reprocessed? And you know what I mean by water. Water is coming from a number of sources. Is much of the water reprocessed, Paul? So, to some degree, they're reprocessing carbon dioxide into oxygen. Some of the oxygen, I think, is being brought up in the cargo ships. Water is being brought up in the cargo ships. Are they simultaneously doing electrolysis to get oxygen, as well as doing the Sabatier effect? Are they doing both in parallel, Paul? So, and tell me about, once again, how much water is being reprocessed. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I heard as long as all the equipment is working, it's almost like 100%. They keep recycling it. I mean, we're talking about the humidity in the air, too. You know, it all goes to these filters. You know, and again, how much power is it taking to do this, all this? I don't know. They do convert everything, clean everything up, and it becomes useful again. And maybe whatever doesn't become useful, maybe that becomes part of the electrolysis group. I'm not sure. Back to you there.
N2XJN, K2RW, go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, thinking about the ice cap on Mars and that in respect to the latest video that I have sent you from the operation from 1959 to 1966 of the base that was designed in 1947 by U.S. Army called Camp Century. Did you have a chance to look at it?
I haven't seen my email in the last couple of days, so I probably haven't yet, Wes. And there appears to be a lot of water and/or solid carbon dioxide at the North Pole on Mars. So, if the astronauts needed water, you'd think, well, they'd just go to the North Pole. Not so fast. Because the temperature up there is a hell of a lot colder than it is at the equator. I think the first astronauts, if they go to Mars, they're going to be near the equator. And even there, I think the average temperature is minus 60 degrees. It's going to take a lot of energy to keep them warm. And I don't know what the number is, but maybe the North Pole average temperature is minus 120. They get some really extreme temperatures on Mars. So although the water is there, it's in a place that's hard to get to, as I see it. I think you said, Paul, that the total solar power the International Space Station has, let me drop it, is 200 kilowatts of solar voltaic energy. 200 kilowatts. Do you have reason to believe that they're using 95% of that? In other words, they got 200 kilowatts of capability. Are they using most of that to run all of this recycling machinery that's recycling water, recycling carbon dioxide, doing electrolysis of water, running other machines, Do you have reason to believe that they've installed all of those last solar cells because they really need, from time to time, that total of almost all of the 200 kilowatts? WS2N, K2LAW?
First of all, I want to say that what Wesley said before was the, he was talking about the MOXIE. The MOXIE was part of the 2020 rover, which is true. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, Wesley. So yeah, that's been approved, and it will be making oxygen when it gets to Mars as a test, a proof of concept type of thing. And eventually, it would need one around 100 times that size to really become an efficient thing for operating on Mars. And as far as the solar panels are producing a little over 200 kilowatts, and they don't need it. They got so much power they don't know what to do with it, which is good because sometimes they'll have a failure. They had a failure for a couple of months. They shut down the P6 area, and they were operating on reduced power, and they still had plenty of power. And you know, they had some kind of problem, and eventually they got that back online when Kate Rubin and Jeff Williams did an EVA. The second EVA, when they did that about a month or two ago, that got back online. And when the space shuttle used to go up and dock, they used to have, let's call them jumper cables, they used to plug into the shuttle. Let me drop it. And give the shuttle a lot more energy than it normally uses. The shuttle doesn't use solar panels, it uses fuel cells, like we talked about before. So, to have these extended missions, the shuttle was really built for like 12 or 13 day missions. It used to be able to go up and stay for 18 days when they had all these solar panels working on the space station. And a couple more days after that if they needed it. So you had these long shuttle missions that were going up there, and they would do four or five spacewalks at a time, and hooking up more pieces to the International Space Station. And that's how they were able to do that. And when the new crew vehicles go up, the new Crew Dragon and the new Crew Starliner by Boeing, you know, with four people at a time, again, there'll be an automatic connection to the solar panels to keep those vehicles charged, running for hundreds of days. They'll be docked for 200, sometimes 240 days. That'll be their capability. And this way, if there's an emergency, they'll be able to use them as a lifeboat to get back. And to keep them active, they'll be hooked up to the solar panels. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, but I was just thinking about Mars. People think that it's far away. I remember 2011 when we spoke about possible Mars tour. But now we have a crisis in here. 8,000 tons per second. That is the melting ice in Greenland.
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
Sorry.
Paul, I forgot. A fuel cell, you put raw material into it, and it gives you electrical power. I'm pretty sure one of the ingredients you give it is oxygen. Is the other ingredient hydrogen? Do you pour oxygen and hydrogen into a fuel cell to get the energy power output? WS2N, K2RAW?
They started with Gemini 5, I think, was the first one to do that. See if it works. And they used them ever since. And all the Saturn, the Apollo rockets and the shuttles all had fuel cells. And you're right, hydrogen and oxygen, and there's some kind of a membrane plate, and as it passes this, one side becomes positive and the other side becomes negative. And they combine, and you wind up with water as a byproduct. could do with methane, any of the hydrocarbons. I know they wanted to have them here on Earth, eventually to power houses. And there was a lot of talk about that at one time. You would use propane, and any of the gas, it's propane or methane, or natural gas, even natural gas with a membrane and oxygen would deliver electricity back to you.
Yeah, it sounds like we've got a reversible process here. If you've got stored oxygen and hydrogen, you pour it into a fuel cell, you get electrical power and water. If you take that water and pour some power into it by electrolysis, you get the hydrogen and oxygen back out of it. And so now, what's the most compact way to store oxygen? Maybe the most compact way is in the water, as long as you know you've got a hydrolysis machine ready to roll and the power to power it. I had a question. Oh, yes. I vaguely remember on Apollo 13, they were real worried about turning off a fuel cell, because if they turn it off, supposedly they could not restart it. I mean, if I stop pouring in hydrogen and oxygen, I don't get electricity. But if I do that interruption, is there some kind of contamination that takes place inside? Do you happen to know what goes on in a fuel cell that if you turn it on, you can't turn it, if you turn it off, you can't turn it back on again? And did the later designs correct that? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, I remember that. They were continuously operating it. And that's why they said that they would wind up with so much water in the space shuttle, they didn't know what to do with it. You can't shut them down, even in the space shuttle. So maybe now they've worked around it, I don't know. But, yeah. So some kind of a catalyst gets this thing started, and you can't stop it. But, yeah, maybe by now somebody's come out with a way to do that. I'm sure they probably did. But, yeah, I'm not even sure what the catalyst was. I've tried to figure out these designs of these things years ago, and I was always amazed that, you know, you can get electricity out of doing this, but the exact chemistry behind it escapes me. It's over my head back even.
Okay, it sounds like even the modern designs of a fuel cell, you cannot turn it off without it somehow contaminating itself in such a way you can't turn it back on. Can you throttle it back? Do you always have to run it at the 100% level, where it's always making that amount of electricity and that amount of water? Can I run it at half speed without doing any damage to it? Because if I don't need electrical power right now, and I don't need water right now, I'd like to throttle it back. And by the way, if you have to run it continuously, does it always need a load on the electrical power? I would guess the answer is yes. So you've always got to take the water back out of it. You've got to take the electrical power out of it continuously when you're running it continuously. So have they ever talked about having the ability to throttle it back? Can I run it at half speed? WS2N, K2LAW?
I don't know. I don't know. I would imagine they'd have to be able to throttle it back. Otherwise, you'd be going through oxygen and hydrogen too quickly. And that's what ran the LEMs, too. When the LEMs landed on the moon, you could stay for 3 days because you had plenty of power. They weren't, you know, there were no solar cells. And they did not have nuclear. But they did have fuel cells, and you wouldn't be able to sit on that moon for 3 solid days just running on battery power. So, I know they had fuel cells running, and they probably never shut them off either. You know, they always said you could hear the noises, the pumps running, and it was very hard to sleep on the moon. Archaeodeck WS2N. Time's enough. 2 minutes. Back to you.
Yeah, on an Apollo mission, for a big section of the mission, there's nobody in the lunar module. They're all sitting in the command service module. You only put two guys in the lunar module just before you do a lunar landing. But if the fuel cell that's on board has to run continuously, when no human being is there and the fuel cell is running, what's it doing? Is the electrical power coming out, going into a dummy load? Because you haven't turned on all the machinery in the lunar module until you put the men in it. As you can tell, we got more questions than we got answers, Paul. I mean, you and I would like to understand all this stuff. You spent a good fraction of your lifetime keeping track of what NASA and the other space agencies are doing. Boy, you've got a passion there, Paul. I'm glad you're doing it. You guys have just listened to TechNet number 1621 and Space Report number 221. And now we're back on the air with our mailbag. So I pass it over to John for his final comments before we sign off. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Yeah, fun to be back, and interesting that quite a few questions tonight that were answered. So I think we're doing well. I want to thank everybody for their kind emails and letters that I received while I was not in attendance, and I appreciate that. So if all goes well, we shall all be back here next Sunday. Same time and same repeater. Back to you, Dick.
Okay. Be kind to each other. Pass it over to Paul for the final. Bye-bye for now. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Okay, 73. I want to see how Orbital Science, I want to see how Blue Origin does on Tuesday with their abort test with the new Shepard. Maybe it'll make the news. We'll see how that goes. 73, WS2N clear. RIW from RYY. Have you received my last email, and if so, could you reply to it?
Okay, I'll go check my email.
Thank you.
Joe, you sent me an email a few days ago with reference to a piece of equipment you offered to me. I thank you, and I won't need that. I just look right now, and in the last few hours, I have not received an email from you. How long ago did you send it?
Well, what you just said is what it's about. So, if you've already seen it.
Yeah, at the beginning of my conversation with you, I mentioned the fact that I thank you for the offer, and I don't need that piece of equipment. My ICR-7000 does that function for me. Go ahead.
Oh, I know that. I realize that, but this one had, like, tone decoder available on different channels. And I just thought, if you wanted to have something that was much smaller, much easier, you could put, like, a bunch of channels in, and it works like a regular, it is a regular scanner, where the RS-7000 is not really, per se, a scanner. You can't put, like, low-band, high-band UHF and have to scan a series of different channels. It really can't do that. This can't. It was for free, so if you don't want it, that's it.
Yeah, I thank you for the offer, and those are nice functions, which I don't think I need right now. But maybe I should reconsider. Bye-bye, you all.
Good night, W2YY. Hey,
time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater.
better. Much better signal, but the ever-present whistle is there. That's all right. I have to jump out of the car and head to the train soon anyway here, but... Yeah, I think, you're used to HP. You had one all those years. I would just go with the basic HP laser printer. I know that if you go up the line, they're faster, but trust me, the basic one's going to be so much faster than your old Model 4. It doesn't really matter at this point. Getting any of that?
I'll head over to Staples and pick up one of those basic lasers. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah, I forget the model number. If I get a chance when I get on the train and get the computer up and running, I'll email it to you. They've changed, like I said, over the years. They keep modernizing them, but it's still the same basic design. It hasn't changed in a long time. So, I still have Amy's. She hasn't used it since she graduated. I have two brother laser printers in the house. I got that color, and then I have a multifunction that my brother gave me that we used for years. Just a monochrome with a scanner built in. And we use that as a copy machine, mostly, and when I need to scan stuff. But the only reason I really stopped using that one is because it's not a network printer, and it wasn't convenient where I had it set up, so I had to hook it up to a print server or something to get it on my network, which I used the Raspberry Pi for, but that's another story.